Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are people willing to do things that don't benefit them or their families? As scientists have moved beyond the limitations of the old selfish gene theory to embrace the notion of group selection, there are still fascinating questions about the ways we are driven to care for others. Is there more to human evolution than genes alone? And if we are wired for individual and group selection, how can we expand our willingness to sacrifice for the health of the planet, which is larger than any tribe or group we might belong to? David Sloan Wilson joins us to talk about this. He is president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. His new book is called Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
What is the relationship between our altruistic thoughts and feelings and the actual things we do to put those sentiments into action?
Well, in the first place, thanks for such a literate introduction. And it is very important to distinguish between those two kinds of altruism in terms of what we do and in terms of what we think and feel. And I think what concerns us most is altruism at the level of action, as I call it. If you ask an altruist what's the perfect world, it will be all about what people do for each other. And how they think and feel about it is only important insofar as it leads to those altruistic actions.
You know that major religions don't deal much with the existence of altruistic emotions, and they focus on actions. Why is it significant to think about that and why that might be the case?
Well, altruism seems to be all about, you know, your intentions, that if you do something with altruistic intentions, then that's somehow better than with other intentions. So with religions, they're very interesting because they are definitely, if you could say one thing about religion, it's about community, creating communities of people that work for each other. So religious communities are very altruistic, defined in terms of action. But when you see how they think and feel about it, actually altruism is notably absent. And religion is portrayed as something that will send you to heaven, basically, that if you behave in the right way, then that's good for you in addition to everyone else. And so altruism defined in terms of thoughts and feelings, that I do something for you and it costs myself, is remarkably absent, not just from Christianity, but from all major religious traditions.
Do you think that's because there's like an inherent lack of, pardon the pun, faith in the capacity of human beings to just want to do things for other human beings without a reward attached?
No, not at all, in fact. I think that one of the things we've learned about evolution is that we're not just selfish in terms of our thoughts and feelings. We're very generous. We're very much prepared to act for the welfare of others as an end to itself, as long as it's safe to do so. And I think that the reason that religion doesn't make use of that so much is that it's simpler to portray the world as something where that everyone either benefits or everyone loses, that the path to salvation leads to my salvation in addition to everyone else's. It makes for a simpler and more streamlined belief system. Altruism is messy because it's good for some people and bad for others. Selfishness is messy for the same reason. You have to think about those categories. But if it's win-win or lose-lose, you don't have to think. And so many belief systems, not just religion, tend to become linear in that way.
How does altruism make groups stronger?
Well, for a group to be strong, it's just essential for members to perform services for each other. Cooperation is what it's all about. And because groups require members to do things for each other, those are inherently vulnerable to more self-serving behaviors that benefit some people at the expense of others within the same group. So that's the weakness that's inherent in all cooperative enterprises and what makes the evolution of cooperation and altruism such a puzzle, because how can a behavior that benefits you at my expense evolve when evolution is all about some individuals surviving and reproducing better than others? That's the puzzle.
And that was something that Darwin himself struggled with.
Indeed. I mean, Darwin, it's so interesting to read about the Enlightenment, something I'm doing very very much now. And what does it mean to have a scientific world view. At the time when this was all starting, it seemed that science was going to more or less reach the same conclusion as religion, which is that nature is harmonious and well-organized at all scales, from an individual all the way up to the biosphere. Because after all, if God is beneficent, then nature must be well-organized and harmonious from top to bottom. But what Darwin quickly realized, the implication of his theory of natural selection, was that order can exist at a low level, such as the beautiful design of an individual organism, but then it can stop, and those organisms can behave towards each other in a way that in human terms we would regard as immoral in the highest degree. And so actually evolution led to a very dark possibility that harmony and order exists at the level of a single organism, but doesn't even extend to the level of a social group.
And that was used, that kind of evolutionary theory was applied in that way, was used by some people to justify selfishness. Is that right?
Well, that's an interesting story. Nowadays, when you say evolution, a lot of people think social Darwinism and that this somehow justifies inequality. It's been associated with withholding welfare from the poor. Republicans are often called social Darwinists, which is funny because most of them profess not to believe in evolution at all. And from the very beginning, Darwin's theory was kind of tarred with this brush, which really goes all the way back to Malthus, that we have this problem of exponential reproduction. There has to be some kind of sense in which the survival of the fittest takes place. And the unfortunate members of society, they just basically deserve to be unfortunate in some sense. So that's a position, but it was not Darwin's position. And it's really not what modern evolutionary theory is about at all. So it's very important to get past these associations of evolution with so-called social Darwinism.
Why did it take so long for mainstream science to accept that group and individual selection could both exist and be balanced with one another?
Yeah, that's a great question, and so happy for you to ask it in such a literate sense. But to complete the solution of the puzzle, I've already given the puzzle. How can an altruistic behavior evolve when it enables others to survive and reproduce better than itself? So the answer is that groups of altruists are going to outcompete groups that are crippled by selfishness, and that if natural selection operates at the group level, favoring successful groups compared to unsuccessful groups, then that's the force that favors cooperation and altruism and group level functional organization in all of its forms. But in the 1960s, then a consensus formed that although this is true, what I just said, that in practice, group selection is always weak compared to within-group selection. And so therefore, everything that evolves must be explained in terms of some form of self-interest. Even the nice things that we see in nature must be explained in some way. It benefits selfish genes. It benefits my genes and your bodies. Everything got rendered as a form of selfishness. And if we zoom out to see the culture at large, what we find is that similar things were taking place elsewhere, that this was also a time in which economics became founded on rational choice theory. So the idea that all individuals are utility maximizing and that became prominent in economics. And it's the same era where Margaret Thatcher said there's no such thing as society, only individuals and family. So it seems that the entire Western civilization took an individualistic turn and wanted to explain everything according to some grand explanatory principle of self-interest. And evolution was kind of, my field of evolution was kind of following suit.
What's fascinating about that belief that economics can be purely rational is that that all falls apart the moment you watch another human being or even are a human being. We don't make rational decisions all the time.
No, not at all. And it's so interesting how the currently dominant position in economics, the so-called neoclassical paradigm, has maintained itself for so long when it's based on such unrealistic assumptions, not only about who we are as people. The so-called homo economicus is a total fiction. And the other fiction is that economic systems exist at equilibrium, which sounds kind of technical. But in the first place, it's something that's totally false. And in the second place, the only reason anyone would assume it is because it simplifies the math. So we have an enormously influential body of theory in economics, which is based on completely faulty foundations and nevertheless has maintained its dominance for decades, actually.
David Wilson is my guest. He's president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. His new book is called Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Wilson, who is president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. His new book is called Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. David, what accounts for the urge we often feel to reciprocate altruistic acts? Is that a factor of culture over biology?
I would say it's certainly part of biology because many non-human species do it. And for anything like this, you have to ask, how would a behavior like that survive in a Darwinian competition with other behaviors? And there it's clear that if you trade favors, then and those who do it are going to get a collective advantage compared to those who don't. So there's a danger with the reciprocal arrangements because you might do something and it won't be reciprocated. That's the weakness. But the benefit, of course, is that the group of reciprocators do very well compared to the non-reciprocators. So there is basically the multi-level selection dynamic in a nutshell.
What about free will? If we are in any way hardwired to act altruistically, and it sounds like we are, is it fair to say we actually choose altruism?
Yeah, free will is one of those questions that have been, of course, pondered by philosophers for ages. But a simple version of it is just elbow room, basically. I have free will when I can make my choices. And if I'm not, if my choices are curtailed, then I don't have free will. And in that sense, then, we all have free will with respect to how we behave. And we tend to choose the options that we have based on their consequences. It's very simple. But what's important to stress is that altruism can be a successful social strategy. You can, you and the others that you help can do very well by altruism, but only under certain conditions. So everyone needs to be judicious about when they're altruistic. You should never counsel someone to be altruistic unless you've established a safe social environment so that they're not actually abused by being altruists.
So in other words, it could happen that people are doing, you know, turning the other cheek so often, doing such good for others that they are destroyed by that generosity.
Absolutely. And I have a whole chapter in my book called Pathological Altruism. Everyone knows that selfishness comes in good and bad varieties, and we designate the good variety as enlightened self-interest. But people tend to think that only good can come of altruism. And that's certainly not true. From an evolutionary perspective, altruism is something which succeeds in some cases and not others. And so you should never counsel someone to be altruistic unless you can expect that behavior to win in a Darwinian competition with more selfish behaviors.
Can you explain what pro-sociality is and how that relates to all this?
Yeah, pro-sociality is kind of sounds like a technical term, but let's contrast it with altruism. Altruism is a two-dimensional word. An altruist benefits others, but also at the sacrifice of themselves. So self-sacrifice is a dimension of the way most people think of altruism. Pro-sociality is a one-dimensional word. It's anything that benefits others or society as a whole, any attitude, behavior, or organization. And the degree of self-sacrifice is just agnostic. If we can benefit others at no expense to ourselves, then so much the better. So prosociality is a nice one-dimensional word compared to the messy two-dimensionality of altruism.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now. We have Dave on the line in Dallas. Hey, Dave.
Hey. How are y'all today?
Very well. Thank
Good.
You.
Hey, I've been listening to the conversation, and I just had a question. I kind of jumped in on it maybe after, a little bit after it began. But you were talking about how altruism is not maybe displayed so much within religion, and that seems to tack contrary to what I've experienced. I'm a Christian, but even with Buddhism and Islam, they all claim to be very altruistic, and even what Jesus did on the cross was altruistic, and the story of the Good Samaritan and the things that they said that are said about love. So I just want you to maybe expound a little bit more on that concept you were talking about.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. And I want to say that I'm a great student of religion. I study it hard. I admire it. And so there's a sense in which religions very much foster altruism at the level of behavior. And they also foster love of others. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so in that sense, altruism is just penetrated. Religion is just penetrated with altruism. And yet at the same time, if you look at the motives and the language of religion, it's very often, and this is true not just of Christianity, but also all of the other religions, is that if you behave according to Christ, for example, then you will benefit along with everyone else. And heaven, of course, is a great example of that. The whole concept of salvation is that in order for you to receive salvation, then you must do all these things, and that includes being very altruistic to others. So that's the sense in which religion is all about altruism, and yet it also provides lots of individual incentives. And who's to say what the real motive is? When I help you, if I'm a Christian, am I helping you because that's just what I think is good and right and what I want to do? Or am I helping you because really deep down inside, I want my own salvation? So that's the kind of the way that selfishness comes into a religious narrative, including a Christian narrative. Interested in your thoughts on that.
Let me see if we still have Dave, and we'll see what he thinks. Dave?
Yes, I'm still here.
Did you want to respond? Do you have similar
thoughts? Well, I would just say that I guess that is going to be an interpretation issue, because that's not altogether true. There's a lot that the Bible has to say. You don't do it because you're going to get something back from it, but because it's right. So it's an issue of right or wrong, as opposed to the reward you get for the right or wrong.
David? Yeah, I'd agree with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Terry in Fort Worth. Hi, Terry.
Yes, I have to point out what seems to me a fatal contradiction at the heart of altruism. You said just a moment ago that you devote a chapter of your book to distinguishing good from bad altruism. But really, as Immanuel Kant points out, the only way to demonstrate altruism is to behave in a self-destructive way. For example, you could give money to a charity, but someone could point out this is in your self-interest in making yourself seem more virtuous to others, or any act that is superficially altruistic can be pointed out to be self-interested. The only way you can really and conclusively demonstrate altruism is to behave in a self-destructive way.
What do you think, David?
So much is contained in that. I want to know where to begin. It's a great point, but it does illustrate, I think, the distinction between altruism at the level of action and at the level of thoughts and feelings. And let me just pick out a certain part of that: the idea that we do things for our reputations. A point I'd like to make during this interview is how different we are as a species compared to other primate species. Most other primate species have dominance hierarchies in which the dominant individuals just take stuff from the subordinates. It's not good for the group. It's a matter of the strong taking from the weak. And the dominant individuals are the toughest and the strongest individuals. In human society, the dominant individuals tend to be the ones that have the greatest status, but that status is bestowed upon them by other members of the group. And so in order to be dominant in human society, you have to cultivate a good reputation. And in order to do that, you basically have to be a very, very solid citizen. So reputation is an extremely important mechanism for human social life, for beneficial human social life. Is it altruistic? No. Few people would call it altruistic. But who cares? And a point that I make in the book is, let's say somebody is going to pay you and offers to pay you by cash or check. You might have a mild preference for one method, but your main concern is to be paid. And so our main concern in human social life is for people to coordinate their activities, not to exploit each other, and basically create well-functioning society. And when it comes to how they think and feel about it, as long as the job gets done, we shouldn't care much any more than we should care about whether we're paid by cash or check.
What forms does altruism or something like it are evident within the animal kingdom, and where do the comparisons stop?
Well, altruism is actually throughout the animal kingdom, and it's most prevalent in the social insect colonies that have been admired by people for centuries. Religious folks are often comparing themselves to beehives because bees work so industriously for the group. But you can find many behaviors in nature that are actually puts the individual at a disadvantage within their own groups, but nevertheless evolve because the groups do better than other groups. And let me give one quick example as fast as I can because not many people know about it. It's a wonderful insect that skates on the surface of the water. It's called a water strider. And the males differ in their aggressiveness towards females. Some males are like psychopaths. They basically hunt for females and mate with them against their will. We'd call them rapists in human terms. Other males are gentlemen, and they wait to be asked to perform their manly duty. So how do we explain these individual differences? And if you put these two different kinds of males in a single pool of water, then the aggressive males always do better than the docile males. They win the Darwinian contest at that scale. But if you look at groups of gentlemen compared to groups of psychopaths, then the females in the groups of gentlemen are able to feed in the first place and therefore may lay more eggs than when they're with a group of psychopaths. So there is where group selection is operating, favoring the docile behavior in males. And what you end up with is a mix because both of those evolutionary forces are taking place. You have the selfish individuals remaining in the population on the basis of their local advantage, and you have the gentlemen being maintained on the basis of their slightly more global advantage. So there's an idea, there's an example of altruism in nature in the form of men who don't harass women.
It's good to know. David.
Yeah, we want more of that, and we want more of that in human life.
David Wilson is with us. He's president of the Evolution Institute and SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University. We're talking about his book, Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with David Sloan Wilson.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with David Wilson, president of the Evolution Institute and author of the new book, Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. David, you mentioned that overall, groups that have higher levels of altruism will outcompete, outsucceed groups that have lower levels of altruism. Given that, you know, from one era to the next, our genes are probably pretty similar to people around the world, why is it that certain groups of individuals would have higher or lower levels of altruism?
That's a great point. Let me make the point in passing that genetic evolution is a lot faster than we used to think. And so it's not beyond the realm of possibility that differences in different parts of the world, behavioral differences, are caused at least in part by genetic differences, because evolution, genetic evolution, is that fast. But for the most part, differences are caused by cultural differences. And part of my book actually is devoted to showing that there's more to evolution than genetic evolution. Cultural evolution counts as an evolutionary process. And so therefore, all of the fast-paced changes taking place around us can be understood from an evolutionary perspective, not necessarily genetic evolution, but cultural evolution. And it's there that you can see the emergence of social units at all scales, including nations, which basically work better as units. They're more cooperative, and the mechanisms that cause them to be cooperative might or might not look like altruism, but nevertheless, there is a process of competition at that scale which is more or less responsible for the cooperation that we see in the present day.
What does altruism have to do with our willingness to forgive the transgressions of people who have hurt us?
Right. So forgiveness is a great thing to think about. And in many ways, it's if somebody was just unconditionally forgiving, if they took the dictum, turn the other cheek, all the time, then such an individual couldn't exist. So forgiveness, it might sound strange, is conditional, or at least it should be conditional. There are situations in which to forgive others is the right thing to do, and other cases in which it's the wrong thing to do, because after all, one has to protect themselves. And if you've been abused or exploited, then you can't really set yourself up for that to happen again. In a religious context, turn the other cheek, actually what it often means is please don't try to settle your quarrels yourself. Leave that to the church. And then the church is what applies the social control and tries to inculcate forgiveness among members of the church is one way that the turn the other cheek and forgive us our trespasses clauses in religion, how they actually work.
So we have these sort of cultural and biological mandates to balance individual altruism and selfishness with that that affects the group. What do we do now that we are in an era where some of the greatest threats to our ongoing survival affect us not, you know, tribe to tribe, nation to nation, but in fact as an entire planet?
Yeah, that's thank you for asking that question. And it raises the point that we live in a multi-tier hierarchy, groups within groups within groups. And everything that is associated with selfishness actually goes for altruism with respect to the next highest tier. Sorry for that to be complicated. But basically, what's good for me can be bad for my family. What's good for my family can be bad for my clan. What's good for my clan can be bad for my nation. And what's good for my nation can be bad for the global village. And so this is like the opposite of the invisible hand concept in economics. The invisible hand concept pretends that the pursuit of self-interest automatically works out as if by an invisible hand for the benefit of society. Evolution tells us no, 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 if we needed to be told, is that often when individuals pursue their self-interest, it undermines the welfare of society. And that takes place at every rung of the ladder, so that now we have, for example, politicians preaching to their own citizens that they care only about the national good, the welfare of the nation, blissfully unaware that this is a form of selfishness at the planetary scale.
So what does it take for us to sort of transcend that tendency we have to think about our own, even in terms of using altruism?
It is formidable. I think there's cause for pessimism and cause for optimism. We need to cooperate at a larger scale than ever before in human history. That's the bad news. The good news is that the principles that would enable us to do it are actually at hand. And basically, they're the same mechanisms of social control that operate at a small scale. The small group, it's so interesting to look at small human social groups because they tend to regulate themselves spontaneously. They tend to hold each other in check. And that's because the small group has been the natural human social unit for most of our evolutionary history. And so if you want to know how to organize a large group, look to small groups and then try to scale it up is the solution. And what we need to do is to scale it up that final rung so that we have a true global village. That old metaphor, the global village, is exactly what we need, in which the nations are now the individuals, the members of the global village that hold each other in check in just the same way that individuals do in a real village.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Mary on the line in Corinth. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
My son, I have a son that's a sophomore, and he has to do so many hours, like 12 hours of community service, and it's a grade. And I wanted to know, it always feels like as parents, we're setting up the community service, we're pushing them to do it. And it takes away from the idea of community service. And I want to know what your thoughts are about that as far as teaching kids to be altruistic or to be more charitable.
Sure, mandated altruism. What do you think, David?
Yeah, well, thank you, Mary. I think that you're right. That whenever you're coerced, then you've broken a certain rule, and you don't want to do it. You're not going to teach altruism by forcing people to be altruistic. At the same time, to provide an opportunity and to introduce students to something like that, then I think often it can be an eye-opening experience, as long as it ends up being their choice. We try to make opportunities here at Binghamton University for our students to just become involved in the community, something that they're not going to do, basically, often on their own. And we start by just having them do door-to-door surveys with us, which we do a lot of. And almost without exception, these college students who don't really know the city well, they start to just do these surveys, and they just talk to the residents on their doorsteps. And that ends up being a transformative experience for them because they just discover the humanity in this new town that they live in. And so often those students thank us for the experience and often continue to be involved. So I hope that your son has that opportunity and just doesn't feel like he's being used by this community service requirement.
If you were to chart altruism and altruistic behaviors on a bell curve, is that the distribution that you would see? Are there, you know, lots of people sort of in the middle and some people on either end of the spectrum?
That's exactly what you see, and this is exactly what we do. And I think that altruism is most interesting when you study it in your hometown or anybody's town. And when you do that, what you find is, in the first place, it's not hard to measure altruism and that self-report measures actually are pretty accurate. If somebody says, I think it's really important to help others, then they probably do. And if someone says, I don't give a damn, they probably don't. So you can study this in a hometown, and then you can begin to see why are those individual differences maintained. It's quite a bit like the water striders. How is it that some individuals can be nice and get by being nice, whereas others follow a different strategy? Why is that? And can we understand that as this kind of Darwinian contest of social strategies that we all have options to employ. Back to that idea is that we're all, in a sense, evolutionary agents who can behave in different ways, and that we don't always select our behavior. Sometimes our behaviors are selected by their consequences.
David Wilson is SUNY Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University and President of the Evolution Institute. His new book is called Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. David, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.